everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is the takeaway for July 29th. Islamophobia is on the rise, and Muslim leaders in politics are working to make their voices heard.
I don't think I can withstand allowing my children and their children to exist in the pains that I've existed in, and many others like me have existed in this country.
We're taking a closer look at the Muslim constituency and the 2020 election. Plus, we try to keep track of all the Trump administration's recent changes to the country's immigration system.
The administration has gotten used to the fact that everything it proposes via the executive branch is going to be challenged in court.
Also, does anyone want the job of governor of Puerto Rico?
Right now, it kind of feels like there is no government.
And the Amazon Ring lets people keep an eye on their doorstep through an app, but they may not be aware Amazon is teaming up with police departments.
It's essentially helped police build a surveillance network in areas that they never really had access to before.
All right, everybody, let's get started. Islamophobia and Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise since President Trump was elected in 2016, reaching higher numbers than during the immediate aftermath of September 11th. Throughout his time in politics, the president has only fueled these divisive flames.
I think Islam hates us. There's something there that there's a tremendous hatred there. There's a tremendous hatred. We have to get to the bottom of it.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Umar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Since Trump's election, the number of Muslim candidates running for office has also risen, with at least 90 Muslim candidates running for positions in the 2018 midterm election, up from just a dozen in 2016. Last week, the Muslim Caucus held a conference they called the Muslim Collective for Equitable Democracy in Washington, D.C. The conference was billed as the first national gathering of Muslim politicians, and among the attendees was Representative Ilhan Omar.
We forget that this system of oppression that continues to build and continues to other so many of us and vilify us in the process to almost eliminate our existence in many aspects of society. And so I think, at least for me, it's not that I'm going to allow it to distract me, but I'm interested in unmasking it and taking it to task.
But just three presidential candidates spoke at the conference. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio was the only candidate who came in person. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Washington Governor Jay Inslee joined by live stream. Many of the caucus's organizers expressed discontent that their reliably Democratic voting members are being overlooked by the party and taken for granted. Joining me now is the founder and president of the Muslim Caucus, Ghazala Salam, and Arsalan Iftikhar, a human rights lawyer and senior research fellow for the Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University, a research project on Islamophobia. Ghazala and Arsalan, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having us, Tanzina.
Thank you.
Arsalan, let's start with you. We just mentioned the rise in Islamophobia in the last couple of years in the United States. How has that manifested?
Well, Tanzina, I think for the first time in American history, you had an American president who said that there should be a total and complete shutdown of all Muslims entering the United States. I think that had he said this about any other minority demographic group today, he probably wouldn't have gotten away with it. And I think that it's important to keep in mind that this is just a small microcosm of his long history of Islamophobia. He once famously told CNN's Anderson Cooper that, quote, "I think Islam hates us. He's called for the surveillance of mosques. He started the Barack Obama birther controversy about President Barack Obama being some sort of crypto-Muslim. And, he surrounded himself with people in the White House like Steve Bannon, Sebastian Gorka, Stephen Miller, all who've made Islamophobic statements. And so, sadly, Islamophobia has now become part and parcel of the Republican Party ideology today.
And is the Islamophobia that we're witnessing today different than the rise of Islamophobia in the aftermath of 9/11?
Yes, for the sole reason of the fact that the commander-in-chief is, making Islamophobic statements, both with George W. Bush and Barack Obama, you know, they went out of their way to let the American people know, to let the global public know that, you know, that we were not at war with Muslims or Islam. And Donald Trump has literally laid that to the wayside. And I think as we move towards the 2020 election, for Muslims, at least in the United States, we have to serve as intersectional allies to other minorities who have been disenfranchised by Donald Trump's presidency.
Ghazala, can you tell us a little bit about the conference that happened a couple days ago? What were your goals in what were you hoping to accomplish, and what would have made the conference a success?
First, I think the conference was very successful. Our goal was to bring together American Muslims, activists, organizers, policymakers, candidates, elected officials, community leaders in a space that was safe to discuss issues that impact our communities, not just the American Muslim community, but the American communities at large. And I think we were very successful in doing that. We wanted to make sure that the politicians and the media were aware of the diversity in our community, because I think when people tend to believe the stereotypes, they tend to think that our community is a monolithic. We only are one issue-based community. So we wanted to make sure that the diversity of the American Muslim community, who is here in this nation, who are who've been here from the very beginning of this nation, who are a fabric of this nation. African Americans make up a third of the American Muslim community. And so we come from 90 different nations, ethnicities. We just wanted to make sure that the awareness was there that we are diverse, our issues are diverse, and we're not a monolithic. We don't all speak the same way or vote the same way. And I think we were successful in getting across that message.
Tell me a little bit about the reaction as you were preparing this organization. Was there any pushback in advance?
I think, you know, there were pushbacks from some organizations. You know, people could not see the vision of why such a conference was needed. People were thinking, well, this sort of work is already being done. Lots of organizations are doing great work across the country. But our vision was to, create a national infrastructure for American Muslims to organize and win at very grassroots levels, because, you know, politics is local, as we all know, and we want to make sure that we're building our capacity, resources, and leadership, not just within the American Muslim communities, but as Arsalan just mentioned, the other communities who are being, you know, who've been inflicted by being othered by this administration. We want to make sure we're building our collective power as American Muslims.
And as we know, of course, we cannot ignore the fact that there is a critical election coming up in 2020. There were three presidential candidates, all Democrats, who spoke, who at least were at the conference. De Blasio was there in person. Inslee and Warren, as we mentioned, did so via video. What are Muslim voters looking for in 2020? And was the response from the Democratic candidates sufficient, in your opinion, Ghazala?
I think the response could have been deeper. There more discussions need to happen on issues that impact the American Muslim community. Islamophobia needs to be addressed, and conversations need to be had at every level of administration. So whoever the next president is, not only will they, I think, automatically have to repeal the Muslim ban, but also look at other policies that are impacting communities just because of their race and their religion has to be looked at in a deep way. And making sure that their cabinets, are reflective of members of our society. I think a lot of times people are hesitant to vote because they don't see themselves on the ballot. And we need to make sure that whoever is elected as the next president is actually representative of all constituents in the United States.
Arsalan, I'm curious your thoughts on that. What policy initiatives or otherwise are Muslim voters going to be looking for in 2020? And as we mentioned at the top, this is a group of voters that tend to swing Democratic. Do you think this community has been sort of taken for granted by the Democratic Party?
Well, the short answer is yes, and the long answer is yes. I think that when you look at any historically marginalized minorities in American society today, especially from the latter part of the 20th century onwards, you know, they have traditionally politically aligned themselves with the Democratic Party, whether it's African Americans or Latinos or women in general. And so obviously Muslim Americans, since we've, caught the disparate brunt of the post 9/11 backlash, so too do we now overwhelmingly vote Democratic. I think what's interesting for me, at least, is that, you know, I'm not that as concerned that whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee, you know, won't overturn the Muslim ban and things like that. But there is a lot of harm and damage that has been done by Donald Trump during his administration, whether it's, the Paris Climate Accord or, you know, turning back other, Obama initiatives. And so, this is, again, it's going to be an all hands on deck approach, when it comes to mobilizing, ensuring that, you know, it's not only enough that we show this sort of, you know, righteous indignation against Donald Trump on social media, but when it comes to Election Day 2020, that we actually get out and vote, particularly in the battleground states of, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Florida, and making sure that, our ground game, so to speak, politically for minorities and people of color in the United States, when it comes to getting out to vote, getting people registered to vote before 2020, I think the ground game is going to be the thing that is going to decide who wins the next election.
And we mentioned also that there have been an increase in hate crimes against Muslims in this country. What do you expect, if any, the response to that to be from either the FBI, the Department of Justice, local police departments?
Or Donald Trump, which has been nothing. A couple years back, there was a brutal murder in Portland, Oregon, on a public city bus where two Good Samaritans were murdered by a white supremacist just because these two Good Samaritans were trying to protect a young Muslim woman and her friend who were at the receiving end of Islamophobic statements. A couple of years ago, we had three young Muslim college students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who were shot point blank in the head, execution style, in their own apartment by a neighbor named Craig Hicks, who had frequently posted anti-Muslim diatribes on Facebook. Earlier this year, we saw in Christchurch, New Zealand, where there was a mosque massacre where 50 people were brutally murdered by another white supremacist. We saw that happen in Quebec City, Quebec, a few years ago. And so we're not only seeing, the rhetoric of Islamophobia, we're now seeing Islamophobia weaponized to the point where you're seeing Islamophobic hate crimes, similar to the anti-Semitic hate crimes that we saw at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh or in Poway, California. And so it's really not only important enough to condemn xenophobia, but understand that it can then become weaponized by white supremacists, which is what it has, and it leads to the death of innocent people.
Ghazala, last thoughts on that point from you. I mean, with the rise of hate crimes and Islamophobia, what type of response do you expect to see? We've got a little under a minute left.
So I think that other countries are being emboldened by seeing the lack of attention given to the Islamophobia in this country and all the hate mongering and othering of communities coming from the top level office of this administration is emboldening countries like China in their treatment with the Uyghur Muslim community, Burma, India with the lynching of Muslims, Saudi Arabia with everything that they're doing. So we have to first look at our own country and see how we are holding ourselves accountable when it comes to justice and equity for all, and then be able to hold and call out these other countries for their human rights violations and injustices towards minority communities.
Ghazala Salam is the founder and president of the Muslim Caucus, and Arsalan Iftikhar is a lawyer and fellow at Georgetown University. Ghazala and Arsalan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Since taking office, the Trump administration has enacted policy change after policy change in an effort to deter migrants and asylum seekers from entering the United States. If you're having trouble keeping up with these changes, you're not alone. Beyond the headlines, many of these policy changes are being challenged in court, leaving immigration attorneys and those seeking to migrate to this country in a state of confusion. Here to help us get through some of these is Dara Lind, immigration reporter with ProPublica. Dara, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on. I apologize for the state of the news.
I was just going to say, before we get into specifics, I mean, can you help us understand, is there a strategy here beyond deterrence that the Trump administration is trying to employ, or is confusion part of that strategy?
So deterrence certainly isn't nothing. And I think even beyond that, the administration has gotten used to the fact that everything it proposes via the executive branch is going to be challenged in court, usually in the Ninth Circuit, and is going to be held up at least temporarily. And so they're doing a couple of things. One, they're getting everything that they assume will be challenged out the door so that they can get it up to a Supreme Court that they think might be more favorable to them, although the Supreme Court has not been quite as amenable to them as they might like. And they're trying to use provisions in the Immigration and Nationality Act that go beyond just the standard, well, we're the executive branch, so we can do this.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the strategy that the president employed or the administration employed with Guatemala, because with Mexico, at least from what we understand, there were threats of increased tariffs on Mexico if Mexico did not play nice with the U.S. government and work with them to deter migrants from coming into our country. There was also talk of the Trump administration imposing tariffs on Guatemala. Is that how did they basically were they able to strong arm Guatemala into doing this?
That is certainly how it appears. We know that the Trump administration was working on signing this type of agreement with Guatemala, which is generally called a safe third country agreement. Neither the Trump Department of Homeland Security nor the Guatemalan government is calling it that. Donald Trump is calling it a safe third agreement because Donald Trump is often off message for his own administration. But that's the general term for this kind of treaty. And we know that they were working on something with the Guatemalan government up until a couple of weeks ago when the Guatemalan High Court, their constitutional court, issued a ruling saying that the president of Guatemala, who is leaving in several months and who the front runner in their presidential race has said that they are not supportive of that agreement. And the High Court said, you can't sign this without consulting our legislature. And the legislature is also strongly opposed to this kind of agreement with the U.S. because Guatemala doesn't really have much of an asylum system to speak of. They have approved zero asylum applications in 2019 so far. So this is expecting the Guatemalan system to exist in a way it really doesn't. So there is going to be a constitutional crisis in Guatemala because of the pressure that the Trump administration has put on the Guatemalan government. We just don't know if that's going to result in this treaty kind of being a dead letter or whether it's going to be imposed over the wishes of two-thirds of the Guatemalan government.
Now, there was, moving on, there was an asylum policy change last week that was blocked by a U.S. judge. Some were calling the change an asylum ban. What was the policy change and what would it have done?
So it's actually really helpful to think about this after the Guatemalan agreement because this was a regulation, so just unilaterally imposed by the Trump administration, that said if you crossed through another country before arriving in the U.S. and did not apply for asylum there, you are not eligible for asylum here either. So that would have applied not only to to the Salvadorans and Hondurans and other nationalities who are now affected by this you didn't cross through Guatemala policy, but also to Guatemalans who had crossed through Mexico. And after, given the kind of continued delays in processing asylum seekers, especially at ports of entry where people have been waiting for weeks or months, it did mean that some people who had been trying to follow the rules were now kind of being locked out. That ruling did not last for very long. It's not clear whether anyone was actually deported under it before it got blocked. It got blocked after about 8 days on the books. And it got blocked by the same judge who blocked the asylum ban that they attempted to put in place last fall, which would have blocked asylum for anyone who crossed between ports of entry. And the judge, it wasn't as open and shut a case as last fall was, but the judge said, look, Congress has put a couple of standards in place for if you've been in another country for long enough that you have resettled there, you don't get to then claim asylum in the United States. Or if you've signed one of these agreements with another government, then you get to say that people can't claim asylum based on that. But the existence of those strongly implies that Congress didn't mean that if you didn't just arrive in the U.S. directly, that you wouldn't be able to claim asylum.
There's another recent policy change that would expand expedited removals of undocumented migrants by ICE. What is the status with that policy and who is it most at risk now?
So this is unlike the regulation or the kind of Guatemalan agreement. This in theory could be in place immediately. It just issued as a notice because that's another authority that they have under the Immigration and Nationality Act to just kind of expand the use of this. And we don't know a lot about how it's being put in place. We know that before last week, the U.S. government could deport you without a court hearing if you had been caught within 100 miles of the of a border, and if you couldn't show that you had been in the U.S. for more than 2 weeks. They've now expanded that so that you can, in theory, be removed without a court hearing if you're arrested anywhere in the U.S., and if you can't demonstrate that you've been physically present for at least 2 years. That's a huge jump, and it's not at all clear how they plan to, you know, whether ICE agents are going to be allowed to just assess whether someone's been in the U.S. for 2 years based on what they're carrying on their person at the time they are arrested, whether there's going to be some kind of procedure in place for people to, like, get documents that they may not be carrying with them in order to show an agent that they've been in the U.S. for 2 years. So if you, in theory, because there's no sort of judicial review here, if you can't go before a judge to plead your case, the possibility of error here is massive. I mean, we've just had a very high profile case of someone with a U.S. passport being detained by ICE for weeks on the argument that he was falsely claiming to be a U.S. citizen because they weren't reviewing those documents. The possibility that someone who is not only that, like, long resident unauthorized immigrants who have been here for more than 2 years couldn't prove that, but that people who are actually legal immigrants or even U.S. citizens might not have whatever documents they need with them at the time to demonstrate 2 years of what's called continuous physical presence is a really big one. And so there are lots of very live questions about how exactly ICE plans to use this, whether it's something they're actually going to use on a regular basis or whether it's just kind of another thing that they're doing to just send the message to immigrants that they're not really safe.
Dara Lind is an immigration reporter with ProPublica. Dara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For the first time in history, Puerto Ricans witnessed the resignation of a sitting governor. Ricardo Rosselló announced last week that he will step down this Friday, and the current Secretary of Justice, Wanda Vasquez, is next in line to take over until the 2020 elections. But over the weekend, Vasquez tweeted that she doesn't actually want the job. She's hoping Rosselló will appoint someone else to replace him before he leaves office. Natalia Rodriguez Medina covers Puerto Rico for the news organization Latino Rebels, and she's here with us today. Hi, Natalia.
Hi, Tanzina. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So what is the state of the government in Puerto Rico as we speak?
Well, right now, it kind of feels like there is no government. There's a lot of uncertainty and there's a lot of quietness from Fortaleza. Rosselló has been signing laws and we keep getting, like, press releases of things he's doing, but we haven't really seen him. And honestly, the government kind of feels like it's in disarray. It feels like everything's crazy and up in flames still.
So the Secretary of Justice, Rosselló, is expected to step down this Friday, and Secretary of Justice Wanda Vasquez would be the next in line in the terms of the constitutional order of things. But she does not want the job, and protesters have immediately started calling for her to resign as well. Who is Secretary Vasquez, and why is it that people want her out?
So she's the Secretary of Justice, and she's been in the position since 2017. And actually, pushback has been coming from her for her to resign for a while, like before Rosselló actually resigned. People wanted her to quit because she has a sketchy history in her position. In late 2018, she was under investigation for ethical violations. It recently came out some documents that incriminate her in a way that it seems that she willingly looks over, decides not to investigate some things because it would, like, incriminate people from her party or friends of hers. She's had a very, very rough term as Secretary of Justice. And since the Secretary of State resigned and it became known that if Rosselló stepped down, she would become governor, the hashtag Wanda Renuncia has been trending and people have been pushing back on her since she tweeted yesterday that she didn't want the job. And a lot of people are just like, well, just resign, get it over with. We don't want you.
Now, Vasquez is also, she wasn't part of the most recent corruption scandal that included the Secretary of Education and others, but she has been the subject of some ethical complaints. And I believe in November 2018, she even faced criminal charges. Was that right?
Yeah. So apparently she was in an ethical investigation because she intervened in a case that involved her daughter and son-in-law. She was temporarily suspended from her job, but then she was cleared of everything and she just regained her job again and continued working.
We've been hearing rumors of backroom negotiations to have someone else take over instead of Vasquez. But within the week here, there's not a lot of time to create a new government. So in the interim, is there anybody that could assume the position at least until a new election cycle in 2020?
So if there's no Secretary of State, it's going to be Wanda Vasquez. If she decides not to take it, the next in line would be the Secretary of Treasury, but because he's not 35 years old, he can't become governor. So the next in line would be the Secretary of Education, whose name is Eligio Hernandez Perez, who's the person who took over after Julia Kelleher resigned. Julia Kelleher was the one who was arrested a couple of weeks ago for corruption charges after her term as Secretary of Education. So, yeah, if none of these people take the job, the governor would actually become Eligio Hernandez Perez, who is the Secretary of Education.
Natalia Rodriguez Medina covers Puerto Rico for Latino Rebels. Natalia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
One of the biggest bestsellers on Amazon Prime Day earlier this month was The Ring. That's a doorbell camera where you can see video of who is at your front door via your phone. Now, new reports have come out to show how local police departments are collaborating with Ring and Ring users, which has privacy advocates worried. Alfred Ng is a staff reporter for CNET News who's been covering Ring.
Ring was bought by Amazon last year in 2018 for a reported $1 billion. They expected to sell about 3 million video doorbells in general, so not just Amazon's Ring, because Google has their own version with Nest. In 2018, they got really popular over the last 2-3 years or so because people wanted security. They wanted to be able to see their doorsteps from a doorbell, and on their phone app, they wouldn't have to go out and see who's there. And in case somebody stole their packages, they would have video evidence right there.
Who's the typical Ring customer?
So the typical Ring customer is somebody who has a doorstep in a suburban area that is worried about package thieves or, you know, anybody coming to their doorsteps, concerns about that, and wants to be able to record it at all times. Basically, if you have a doorstep, chances are you're in the market for Ring.
How does Ring work for those of us who how does it work exactly? What does it do?
Yeah, think of Ring as a doorbell that's connected to the internet and also has a camera on it. So you plug it in, and they sometimes come with battery packs, or if you have an extension cord long enough, you can drill a hole and plug it into a power source in your house. And it records all the time, but it doesn't save that footage. It only really saves footage if it sees motion. And if you have a $3 subscription fee, you can save that footage and, you know, upload it or send it to your friends and things like that. And it's sensitive enough that police departments said that they've been able to pick up license plate numbers on cars that have just driven by.
So let's take a step back, because at first I'm thinking this is just something I'm using in my home, but we keep talking about police departments using it. How are police departments using Ring? Like, isn't this something the average consumer can buy for themselves for their own personal safety and package safety? Like, why is there a police relationship here?
Yeah, so more than 50 police departments have partnered with Ring over the last year or so. Amazon's Ring often shows up to police conferences to show off their products. They have booths there. And they'll do deals with them, too, where if they get 25 people to sign up for the Neighbors app, which Ring owns, they'll give them a free camera, and they'll give them 20 free cameras to start with to raffle off and things like that. When they're partnered on this Neighbors app, what they can basically do is geofence a certain area and request residents in that area saying, hey, we're trying to solve a crime, or we're looking for footage that happened between this time and this time in this area. If anybody has footage of somebody, can you please send it our way?
Do consumers know that the police are working with Amazon in general when they're using Ring?
Most of the times, no. In general, they don't really know if their police department's working with them or not. If you're not a part of the Neighbors app, you're really out of the loop here on these kinds of things. But police still know if you're a Ring owner or anything like that. So they can post on the Neighbors app itself. They can say, hey, we're this police department. We're going to be posting alerts here from time to time. We're also going to be requesting for footage in the same way that, you know, your police department might have a Facebook page or a Twitter account.
Does Ring use facial recognition? Because Amazon is toying with this technology right now. And so I'm imagining there might be, and police departments are deciding whether or not they want to use facial recognition. So are we there yet?
So Ring itself does not use facial recognition, though it did land itself in some hot water last year when they applied for a patent to use facial recognition with Ring. That being said, the footage captured from it can still be meshed with facial recognition. Police department in Indiana talked about how they used footage from Ring in the past to match with license plate readers to be able to potentially track cars all around the city if they catch it on footage with a Ring doorbell. That being said, the idea is if they take that footage, they can use any software that has facial recognition capabilities and do that.
Alfred, I guess, you know, when we talk about technology and police using technology, often we talk about the positives of it, but also the concerns around it. And that usually references privacy. Are there any major privacy concerns here that have come up so far in your reporting?
Yeah, the biggest privacy concern with Ring is that it's essentially helped police build a surveillance network in areas that they never really had access to before. You know, they have surveillance cameras around cities, but most of the partnerships that I found with Ring are in small towns, areas that have less than 30,000 people. And they don't have the money to have surveillance cameras in residential neighborhoods. Most residential neighborhoods, to begin with, don't really have surveillance cameras everywhere. And now with Ring, one, police departments don't have to buy it. And two, they can ask people to buy it and, you know, just ask for the footage free of charge.
Do police departments generally have access to the footage, whether it's given to them by consumers or not?
They can't just grab the footage itself. They can't just go in and take it unless it's part of the agreement. So police departments do giveaways a lot on these Ring cameras. Most of the times, there are no strings attached, but I found a few. There was one in Houston and there was one in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where they had to agree to provide the footage if they got a free camera from the city itself. So Amazon has said that they don't allow that and they've been trying to clamp down on that, but over the last 2 years, we found these two cases where even without a warrant, even without a subpoena, people were required to hand over that footage.
Is this ultimately making people paranoid? Is this setting up some sort of surveillance community, which is unwarranted at this point? Because you've got average citizens who are saying, hey, that person looks suspicious or that car looks suspicious. And again, there's this need for safety, but are we taking it too far with this Ring technology?
Yeah, it's definitely created a social network of fear where if you look on the Neighbors app itself, and there's been a lot of reporting on this from Motherboard where they just look at the app in like certain neighborhoods where people will post people of color and say, hey, this person looks suspicious, even though they're just walking through the neighborhood. And yeah, it creates this level of paranoia and it comes to people at a tap on their phone now. They get notifications for this app the same way you would get notification on Facebook or Instagram or something like that. But now it's just people inciting fear without any evidence.
Is there any sense that there might be some sort of regulatory body looking into this at some point, looking into the privacy implications? I don't know if the Federal Trade Commission might be looking into this. Is there any sense that our local community governments might be saying, you know what, here's where this should begin and end? Or is it just a private sector, you know, thing that we've got to have to accept if we use Ring?
So far, this hasn't popped up on any radars of any lawmakers or anything like that. A lot of city governments actually support Ring partnerships. I know that in Indiana, they actually helped pay for $18,000 in discounts. Amazon actually put up the other half of that. It gained 600 new subscribers within that year. Just based off of this one town, a lot of city governments think that this will help solve crime. There hasn't really been a big discussion on the privacy issue or racial bias issues or anything like that when it comes to security cameras like Ring.
I've been speaking with Alfred Ng, staff reporter with CNET News, about Amazon Ring. Alfred, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.